We are glad to make all of our JCast Network podcasts free for our listeners. However, they are not free to produce and host. Please consider making a donation to JCast Network to help support our work by visiting jcastnetwork.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got a wonderful show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we are going to be interviewing, very fascinating, his name is Steve Fallon. He's a Blue Badge tour guide from London, and we're going to be contacting him all the way from London. He's doing a series of online virtual walking tours of London's Jewish East End. Very interesting thing. And we're going to be talking about some history of the East End and how you can participate in his walking tour. We've got wonderful music scattered throughout the show. This is, of course, a cappella for the next couple of weeks. And one day, sometime during the next couple of weeks, we'll explain why. The portion of the week is the portion of Tazria Metzora, and it can be found in the book of Leviticus, starting in chapter 12 and following. We have a really fun Hasidic story at the end. It's actually a very famous story. I heard this story out the first time maybe 40-something years ago. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. An Iranian cargo ship, reportedly a spy ship belonging to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, was attacked in the Red Sea off the coast of Etruria with a mine. Israel and Iran have been attacking each other's ships. In other news related, Israeli jets blew up an Iranian warehouse in Damascus, killing three people. A bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers reintroduced a bill requiring the U.S. State Department to address hate and violence in the Palestinian school curriculum. Let's see what happens with that. In anti-Semitic incidents this week, this is the brunt of the news this week, an Orthodox Jewish couple and their baby visiting New York City were slashed by a knife-wielding man in Battery Park. The attacker was arrested and charged with assault and possession of a weapon. A Jewish cemetery in Denmark was vandalized with red paint and hanged dolls. Swastikas were spray-painted on two buildings at the University of Connecticut. There have been seven such acts on campus since the school year began. Anti-Semitic flyers were posted at the University of Northern Florida. In general, anti-Semitic assaults worldwide dropped 19% in 2020 due to the pandemic. Vandalism was up 25%. Last week it was Yemen. This week it's Afghanistan. Zvulun Simintov, the last Jew in Afghanistan, left for Israel due to the concern that his safety once the U.S. military leaves the country. Close to 8,000 people applied, since we're talking about going to Israel, close to 8,000 people applied for Aliyah to Israel in 2020, more than double the number in 2019. Applications are up 30% so far this year over last year. And as a public service announcement, Yad Ezra will be offering a pop-up site to administer the COVID vaccine at their building on 11 Mile in Berkeley on April the 23rd, starting at 9 a.m. Call Yad Ezra at 248-548-3663. That's 548-3663. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have on live Mr. Steve Fallon. We're going to be talking about a really fascinating subject. It's the history of London's East End and where we're up to now with their history. And Mr. Fallon will be conducting a virtual walking tour. We're going to be talking about that too. How are you, Steve?
I'm just fine, Herschel. How are you?
Good, thank God. Thank you for taking the time and coming on. So London's, you know, there's always this thing about, which always intrigued me, that the Jewish community, when they first moved to London, they moved to the East End. And when the Jews first moved to the New York City, they moved to the Lower East Side. So, and I was thinking, and what other cities was this the same type of, did they move to the, like, the East Side? But I think it's just the two, because in like Detroit, for example, it was downtown. And Chicago, it's the South Side. And in Los Angeles, it was Fairfax. In Florida, it was Miami. So is there really any kind of thing more than just a little bit of divine providence coincidence that England and New York City are both the East Side?
That's a very interesting question. In fact, it really not even necessarily related to Jews and Judaism. The East part, because of the dominant winds in Europe, I'm not saying it's true in the States, but the dominant winds in Europe, the eastern part of the city is always the dirtiest, most polluted, cheapest area because of the way the wind blows. So in the days when they used coal and, you know, there was dreadful smells from tanning and all that sort of stuff, people moved into the East End because it was cheaper. So this is true in almost every city in Europe, Paris, Budapest, Berlin, certainly London, and the East End was the cheapest. I mean, of course, when immigrants first started coming to the UK, or to London, I should say, it was the Huguenots first, the French Protestants, after the French Revolution. They moved into the East End, followed by the Irish, followed by the Jews, followed by the Bengalis and Pakistanis. So it's traditionally just the least expensive. When things got better, people moved. I mean, there was a bit of a flight after the war as the East End slowly started to go down. But people moved to the West and the North. But the East End was desirable because it was very inexpensive.
That's interesting. That's fascinating. I grew up in Newark, and the East End was where all the tanneries were, and it just occurred to me. I mean, the smell was absolutely wretched in those neighborhoods. But it never occurred to me till just now that that's why the tanneries, which Newark was famous for its tanneries,
in this country, they're called the stink industries. And the stink industries included things like tanning, because they actually used dog excrement.
Right.
It's part of the secret recipe.
Yeah, it's really brutal. Anyway, so Jews have a very long-standing history with Britain. I mean, probably going back maybe to even the Roman times. Would you not say so?
Oh, yes, definitely. There's no actual proof that they came with the original Roman legions or came as traders later. But it is supposed that they did come. They definitely were here with William the Conqueror, William I, in the 11th century, because he actually invited them along to help build what was a completely ruined economy after the the Battle of Hastings and the Norman invasion. Of course, as you probably well know, sadly, that those golden years only lasted about two centuries when King Edward I decided it was time for the Jews. And so Britain has the dubious honor of being the first country in history to actually to deport its entire Jewish population. I mean, things got a lot better, but it took a few years.
Yes. I mean, like when in Shakespeare's time, when he wrote the plays that are so famously anti-Semitic, like the Merchant of Venice, there were no Jews in England at the time.
Well, not publicly, no. But between 1290, when the Jews were deported, Edward I deported them, when they were between 1290 until the time of Cromwell, which of course was the mid 17th century.
Yeah, 1648.
There were Jews living here, either having officially converted as conversos or pretending to be conversos. There was not a huge, but a relatively sizable community of Portuguese Jews and Spanish, including some Spanish, who lived in London. In fact, one of the doctors to Queen Elizabeth I was a supposed converso who, what was it, what his name was? Rodrigo Lopez.
Oh, there you go.
Rodrigo Lopez.
Oh, how could we forget?
Well-known physician in chief to Queen Elizabeth I.
Unbelievable. Okay, so the Jews get invited back. Did they go immediately and settle in the cities? I mean, England at that time was still very much agrarian, and maybe London wasn't the center of activity in England yet at that time.
No, what basically happened was a very learned rabbi called Manasseh ben Israel, who was a Sephardic rabbi based in Amsterdam, where so many Jews had gone after they were expelled from Spain by Isabel and Ferdinand, the people that Americans cherish as the financiers of Columbus, who were actually quite evil. After they expelled their Jews in 1492, Manasseh ben Israel was living in Amsterdam in the 17th century, a very, very learned man. And he actually could see that things were changing after this English Civil War and the king had been deposed. So he approached Oliver Cromwell with his so-called humble addresses, asking if Jews could be readmitted to England in exchange for an oath of allegiance. Now, Cromwell brought it to Parliament, and it never did pass, but Cromwell let it be known that they would not be obstructed from coming back. So, yeah, they came pretty quickly. And this was about 1650s, early 1650s.
Mm-hmm.
In 1657, the first synagogue opened in what is now the city of London, called on Creechurch Lane, and it was the first synagogue opened since 1290.
Is it in London's East End?
It's in what we call the City of London. There are like 32 boroughs in London, and one of them is called the City of London. It's the financial district, and it's the oldest part of London. It's where the Romans first settled. So it's actually in what is now, it was in what is now the City of London. It doesn't exist any longer. It came down some years ago. But the next synagogue to be built, Bevis Marks, quite famous, went up in 1701. It was a Sephardic synagogue, and it still exists. And it's the oldest continuously used synagogue in Europe.
Okay, it's a very interesting that if you're just joining us, our guest today is Steve Fallon. We're talking about London's East End, and Mr. Fallon will be conducting an online walking tour. We'll get to that. I'm sure you're chomping at the bits. But I have a friend who grew up in London, and he used to make fun of the Americans. But one of the things that he would make fun of the Americans, you know, because the Brits are very, blah, blah, but one of the things he would say is, you Americans, you consider things that are 100 years old, historic, and you go to a big thing and you put up plaques on buildings that are 100 years old. He said, I grew up in a house in London's North End. It was 350 years old, and it was just a house. It wasn't historic. So put in those time perspectives. So do people consider something built in the 1700s a something to take note of in England, Steve Allen?
Yeah, of course they do. I mean, there's a lot of that weird reverse snobism here. When I was doing my course as I'm a blue badge guide, which is a kind of qualification that you get here to guide people in London and the UK. It's about a 2-year program, it's like going back to university. Don't even ask. But one of the instructors once said something like, oh, well, you know, the Americans, their churches and their synagogues look like theaters. You know, they don't look anything like us. And I raised my hand and said, well, I was actually baptized in Milton, Massachusetts, in a church that was actually built in the 1670s. So, you know, not everything is so brand new. And not much really exists in London before 1666, because the Great Fire leveled medieval London. Very, very, very little remains. Yes, in other parts of the country, there are bits and pieces here and there, but not a lot remains from before that. Yes, of course, there is a lot more history here, and it's been settled and lived in for a lot longer than the United States has, but still, we have some pretty nice old things, too.
Okay, so now, you said an interesting point. You said that Cromwell approached Parliament and didn't pass. I was reminded that Jews started moving back to Spain, I don't know exactly when, but Judaism did not become legal in Spain until 1992 by an official act by Juan Carlos. Did Judaism ever become legal in England by an act of Parliament? Or are all those Jews living there illegally?
Well, it wasn't a question of it being banned, just like Catholicism wasn't banned. But in the 1830s, there was something called the Catholic Emancipation, which meant that for the first time, believe it or not, Catholics could vote and run for office. It's a very similar thing with Jews. And the first Jew to actually win an election was Moses Montefiore. I don't know if these names are familiar.
Oh, yeah, sure. Everybody knows Montefiore.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a Sephardic Jew. He was elected sheriff of London in 1837. And then 10 years later, Baron Lionel Nathan de Rothschild was elected to the House of Commons. That was in 1847. But the thing is, he could not take his seat because you were required to swear an oath on the true faith of a Christian.
Okay.
I laugh, but I shouldn't, because, I mean, he couldn't take his seat until 1858, at which point the law was changed, and he, how did he end his oath? By the divine right of Jehovah, he said, rather than a Christian thing. So he finally sat in the House of Commons in 1858, and then his son was the first Jew appointed to the House of Lords in 1885, Nathan Rothschild. So, we could say, if you bend the definition a little bit, you could say that Disraeli was already in the house, but Disraeli had been baptized as a Christian by his father, or his father oversaw it when he was 13, around the time of his bar mitzvah, supposed bar mitzvah. So he was no longer a Jew, although he called himself Jewish, but religiously he was no longer Jewish.
Understood. Okay. So when did the East End then become like everybody else around them would say, the Jewish neighborhood, Steve Fallon?
Well, what really happened was, you know, there were, at the end of the 19th century, you know, Jews mostly, until sort of the end of the 19th century, there were like 46,000 Jews in London. And a large percentage of them were Sephardics. But with the pogroms at the end of the 19th century, Ashkenazic Jews were fleeing from Eastern Europe. As you well know, I mean, mm-hmm. my family, for example, or my Mike's family.
Absolutely.
They were fleeing to the West as they could. The vast majority of them went to the U.S., but about 140,000 settled here. So they then vastly outnumbered Sephardics, and they then began to populate the East End. At first, they went to kind of the Shoreditch area, Whitechapel, Stepney, and that was pretty solidly Jewish until, I would say, after the war. The Jews had replaced the Huguenots and the Irish. They had moved on. And the Jews stayed on until, as late as even, we were still Jewish, very Jewish, until the 1970s, I'd say. Then there was a lot of immigration from Bangladesh and, to a certain extent, Pakistan.
Okay, understood.
Indians moved on quickly too. So.
Understood. How?
In fact, there's a landmark mosque on Brick Lane, which is in this, the nerve center of what was Jewish East London, and there's a mosque there, the great Masjid, and it was a synagogue until 1975. So repurposed it.
Typical story. How big of an area are we talking about that you had 190,000 Jews living there?
Oh, gee, not huge. I'm hard pressed to put a size, but probably 4-5 miles east-west, 3 miles north, south, something like that. Not huge.
Okay,
so you're talking
anywhere 12 to 15 square miles, which that's pretty normal for a Jewish neighborhood, because understanding that if with the Jews coming from Europe, per se, and then the more religious ones coming from the Sephardic countries, from Spain and from the Netherlands, that people on Saturday needed to walk to wherever they were going. And so the synagogue had to be within walking distance from where you were. So people had a tendency to congregate. That's with all of the immigrant Jewish neighborhoods throughout the world. In Detroit, it's just amazing that there were over 100,000 Jews in Detroit in what was essentially a 12 square block area. So it was a very tiny area, and there were 50 butcher shops, and there was all kinds of schools and whatnot. What was the infrastructure, say, Steve?
I'll just add something now quickly, Herschel. There was no real problem about having to walk very far, because at that time, until the war, there were 150 shuls in the East End. 150.
Okay. That's one for every 1,000 people. No, there's one and a half for every 1,000 people, yeah, almost.
Yeah, yes. I mean, some of them were small, some of them were quite large. Bevis Marks was quite a large one. There's a lovely little street called Fieldgate Street, which was quite a small one. It's right opposite the Bell Foundry, where both Big Ben and the Liberty Bell were actually cast. But it's been repurposed now as well as part of a mosque. So this seems to be the trend.
Okay, so... It is quite interesting that during the Blitz, of all the places that the Germans decided to bomb, they could have bombed Buckingham Palace for the same money, but they specifically chose the East End. Was it because of the centralized Jewish population there, Steve Allen?
No, not at all, really. It was because it was the docks. I mean, this is where all the docks were, and they were trying to knock out the economy, pretty much. I mean, it was just pretty coincidental. So, well, maybe not. I don't know. I've never heard that would have been the reason. But and they did actually bomb Buckingham Palace. Buckingham Palace was hit 3 times. So they did get that far. What they did was they came up, they followed the Thames like a map, and went up and bombed the East End. And went as far west as they could go. And on the way back, anything they hadn't dropped already, their payload, they just dropped again. So the East End got it twice, usually, in terms of bombings.
Wow!
But it was really they were really after the docks more than anything else.
Okay, so
it was lifeblood, really.
So from what I said, I have a former boss who actually brought me to Detroit to tell stories that he remembers sitting under a large metal table as like a 4-year-old eating porridge while the Blitz was going on. So quite incredible story. So what's left of what did the Germans leave? What is there to see still? What is the infrastructure that's still standing?
Well, I mean, this is like so many things. I mean, you know, the world has moved on. So things change. They're repurposed, they're rebuilt, they're knocked down, and so on. But there's still a fair amount to see. You've got to, I mean, that's why it's great to have a guide like me, because I can take you to the places, for example, you know, the Novo Cemetery, which is literally a 5-minute walk from where I am right now, which was the first Jewish cemetery in London, built in, because Jews were excluded from Christian cemeteries, the Sephardic Jews built a synagogue in 1735, and then a newer one about 20 years later. And that one still exists. The graves are still there. Among the people buried there is someone called Daniel Mendoza. He was the father of scientific boxing, and is quite a hero, still very well known in the UK. He really caught the imagination of early 18th century London, because he grew up on the docks. He was a porter. He was a poor boy. He got into a lot of scrapes because he was Jewish and so forth and so on. But he invented what we call scientific boxing. In those days, people used to just stand in front of one another and punch each other until they knocked them out. He began to maneuver around, to dart in, dart out. And he became almost like the David Beckham of the century because he was so popular, a number one sports thing. He had little souvenirs of himself sold. He met the royal family. He wrote a book called On Scientific Boxing. So he really opened the eyes, I think, of Londoners to the fact that a Jew could fight and win.
That's fascinating. Okay, so you're going to be conducting a walking tour, and there always were people who were like, they referred to them as the armchair travelers, that they were watching the travel logs and, you know, these type of things. But with this year, with the pandemic and people not going anyplace and really wanting to like have this window to the world, so the armchair traveler has really very much developed. So talk about that and what's that meant to you as a blue badge tour guide, in which is like the creme de la creme in London, Steve Fallon.
Yeah, sadly, I mean, of course, like everyone else, we suffered, tourism in particular, because there were just no visitors. I mean, just people stopped coming altogether. So we began to do weekly broadcasts to all over the world, but especially the States, because so many of our clients come from America, through two of our unions. One's a guild, one's a union. And we will broadcast two or three times a week just to really keep the brand alive. And then we moved on from there to actually offer virtual tours ourselves. And they've been fairly successful, much more successful than a lot of us ever thought. And not only can you offer tours of bits of London and all that sort of thing, but you can also, hold on a second, I just need to get the phone.
We'll take a quick break.
Okay.
No problem.
So not only can you do tours of London, but much broader, like for example, the Jewish East London tour I do, you wouldn't really be able to accomplish this very easily on a walking tour. The area is just too big. But hey, distance means nothing on a virtual tour, so you can see it all. You know, you can also cover subjects that you normally wouldn't be able to. For example, I also do things on the Bayeux Tapestry, the Mayflower, the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower, and the British Library. So you can do things that you normally would not. Well, British Library obviously could, but the Mayflower and the Bayeux Tapestry, you wouldn't. Well, it's in, one's in France and one's between here and the U.S. So, you know, they've been quite successful. People seem to enjoy them. I would say it's never a substitute for the real thing. I mean, you want to see things yourself, you want to experience and so forth. But in this very difficult time right now, I think it's the next best thing.
Uh-huh. Are these interactive? People can ask you questions as you're going. Like, otherwise, I can just watch Rick Steves on TV. I don't need to do this. But that would be the big thing, is if I could like ask questions. Like, could you stop and hold the camera right there for 1 second? There's something I want you to zoom in on, please. That type of a thing.
Oh yeah, sure. When we do like a presentation with PowerPoints and that sort of thing, with some video and all sorts kinds of fancy, you know, technology and so forth. But I'm live, so yes, there's very spirited questions at the end of it. And usually my shtick is that I like to bring a kind of a special guest on, and that for the Bayeux Tapestry, for example, I have this Swedish embroiderer who lives in Cambridgeshire who's actually recreating the entire Bayeux Tapestry, all 70 meters of it. That's 210 feet, or more than 210 feet. She's been working on it for 5 years so far, and she's already finished about 29 meters. And for the Jewish tour, in fact, that was her on the phone just now, quite a well-known artist who is from London, who grew up very close to Cable Street. I don't know if that's familiar to you, but this way, it was a very famous confrontation between the British Fascist Union under someone called Oswald Mosley, who tried to march his black shirts onto East London to intimidate people, especially Jews. He wanted to intimidate all immigrants, but he especially wanted to intimidate Jews. And they fought back. I mean, tens of thousands of people fought back. I mean, with anything they can get their hands on, you know, table legs, kids threw marbles under the horses so the horses would slip and all that sort of stuff. And they beat them off. I mean, they mostly had to flee. So it's something that is near and dear to the hearts of Londoners, especially East Londoners, the Cable Street riots or the Battle of Cable Street. And Hillary, who is an artist, quite a well-known artist, grew up on Cable Street and finds her inspiration from East London.
That's wonderful. This is going to have to wrap it up. I'm sorry. We could talk for a little, devote the whole show to this. But if people want to be participant in the virtual walking tour of London's East End, Steve Fallon, how would they go about doing that?
I think the easiest thing, by way of dates, I'm doing one on Sunday, the 11th of April at 7 p.m. my time, which is 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, mm-hmm. one on the 18th of April at 6 p.m., which is my time, which is 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and one on the 22nd of April at 7 p.m., which is, again, 2 p.m. your time. The easiest thing, they are advertised on Eventbrite, so all you need to do is write Jewish Event. Eventbrite is an American booking agency, so it's probably familiar to most people. Eventbrite, all one word. Just put in Jewish East London, or you can go directly to my website, which is simply www.stevslondon, all one word, Steves London, all one word, .com, and you can just hit the link there, and everything will link you up with how to get tickets.
Wonderful. This is fascinating. So I'm so glad you had to took the time, and I hope this goes very well for you.
Oh, thanks so much. Thank you.
Guys. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Again, if you want to follow that, it's basically the next Sundays, and go check out the website, Steve's London, one word, with no apostrophes, and good chance I'll be there. Sounds very exciting to me. Up next, for your listening pleasure, this is Barry Weber, and the piece is called Chabad's Kapella. Yak didai, yak didai, yai didai, lai lai lai. Yak didai, yak didai, yai didai. Yak didai, yak didai, dai didai, lai lai lai. Yak didai, yak didai, tiri lai lai lai. assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Up next, for your listening pleasure, this is a song from the Maccabees. They come out with an a cappella something every year around this time, and usually some kind of Pesach thing. I guess we're still close enough to Passover. We can still play. The end of this of the Passover Seder is called Nirtza, which means when things are accepted or willing, as the case may be. And this is they've did something called the Seder finale. Let's listen.
Chasal sidur Pesach kehilchaso kechol mishpato vechukaso kasher zachinu lesaderoso ken nizke lasoso ken nizke lasoso. So
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
We all know there's an opiate epidemic,
But Advanced Rapid Detox has a solution for people addicted to pain pills, heroin, and dependent on Suboxone and methadone. Advanced Rapid Detox performs detox under sedation in the hospital. Patients sleep through withdrawals and wake up without cravings. Dr. Julia Aronoff and the staff at Advanced Rapid Detox help people restore their lives and the lives of their families. Addiction affects everyone, even in the Jewish community, and Advanced Rapid Detox is there to help. Call 800-603-1813. That's 800-603-1813, or visit them online at www.advancedrapiddetox.com. Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. This week's portion is the portion of Shemini. It can be found in the book of Leviticus, chapter 12 and following. No, excuse me. It's the portion of Tazria Metzora. Shemini was last week. I got to get it together. I'm actually a little bit far clamped because this is the first time in a year that I've actually been in the studio. So maybe you can hear it, the difference between my mic at home, which doesn't compare to the studio mic. I mean, I've got a good mic, but I didn't go out and spend thousands of dollars for it because I only use it a couple times a week. But so it's, I forgive me. So I'm getting my feet back into this. So it's the portion of Tazria Metzora, which is found in Leviticus chapter 12. It's a set unit of people who are called Mechusa Kapara. We're not going to go into that specifically right now. Those are people who would bring their sacrifices and have to wait until evening before they were finished the purification process. The first one that's mentioned over there has to do with a woman giving birth. There's a very interesting analogy and a comparison of birth. As we look at the embryo, what's the difference between a fetus, which is 40 weeks gestation, the mother is in the throes of labor, and a one-minute-old baby? The answer is, this one's alive, and this one's not. A fetus, all the body parts are there. If you were to, they can do this now, they can do an ultrasound, and they can look and they can see everything is totally, completely the way it's supposed to be on this baby yet to be born, on this fetus yet to be born. But it's as it's described in the Talmud, it has eyes, but the eyes don't see. It has ears, the ears don't hear. Its mouth is closed, and its belly button is open, its navel is open, and it's deriving nurture from its mother rather than it's on its own. Whereas a one-minute-old baby, I'm not exactly sure how much it can see, what it can hear, but it definitely makes noise when the baby starts crying, and it needs to nurse, like, almost right away. It needs to say, like, hey, I'm hungry. It's now feeling this hunger pain, which it hasn't felt till now. And then there's this process in the between called labor. And this is analogous to the Jewish people. It says the Jewish people, when they're in exile, the state in which we are in now, in the diaspora, we have eyes that don't see. We think we're seeing, but we don't see the godliness which is just abounding around us. We have ears, but they're not hearing. They're not hearing really what God is trying to convey to us. And the nurture that we're going to, it's as the expression in Yiddish is, segeitzenboich. It's going right to our pupiks, right down to our tummies. It's not going through our mouths. It's not broadening our ability to rationalize and to feel the spirituality. But rather, it's just, you know, it's going right to our stomachs and the physical world. Beforehand, it says there's something called the Hevelei Mashiach, the birth pangs of the Mashiach, which hopefully we've already gone through, and people say we already have, and we're just waiting for that moment when the Almighty will usher in the Messianic era. And then it's ta-da! And the world, the paradigm, will be totally and completely different. The world will be in a state where we will see. As was described in the book of Isaiah, that famous lines that the sheep and the bear will graze and the lion will play with the lamb cub. And it's all the lion cub will play with the lamb. So meaning in a state of perfection where we will see absolutely what we're supposed to see. And we'll wake up from this gullus, from this exile. Let's hope it's soon. Speaking of soon, we have to take a quick commercial break because this show is coming to an end soon. Don't go away. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Spex Howard. The Spex Howard School of Media Arts is proud to have been a sponsor of The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding comes from its sponsors, listeners like you help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. That's 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Your help is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Hey, Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Go to my website, rabbifinman.com, www.rabbifinman.com. And there you'll find a way right on the homepage to contact me. You contact me, I'll contact you. If you have any question, comment, criticism, query, anything that's on your mind, drop me a line. And I'd love to hear from you. If you're listening on a Sunday, Sundays are usually when I'm at the computer watching this stuff as the show's first posted on Sundays. And usually get a response pretty quick, but the rest of the week, okay, it won't be too long. I like to not have things on my inbox that are pressing and like the answer to your query. There's also archived editions of the radio show. Did you miss last week, the week before that, the year before that? It's like, I think, 4 years back running program. Very good stuff. You could binge listen from today until tomorrow. No problem. There's also other ways in which we convey Judaism in an entertaining and educational way. And there's the very important donations page. To do this program costs, and it has always been listener-supported. Yes, we have some sponsors, but it's listeners that, like you, have kept The Jewish Hour on the air for 25 years. We couldn't have done it without you. And if you've listened all the way till now, we're into 50 minutes into the show. So go to rabbifinman.com, go to the donations page, find some way which is comfortable for you to do that, and do it. Do it today before you forget. You know how things are. I shouldn't have to remind you next week. Don't like internet giving? No problem. Send your donation to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. The story this week, again, involves the Rebbe Rashab, who's the anniversary of his passing, will be celebrated this Wednesday. And there's a story that goes that he was sent by his father when he, the Rebbe Marash, this Rebbe Shmuel, you're talking 1850s, to go to Petersburg to work on a decree against the Jewish people, which at that time, I think it was Nicholas I or one of those czars, I'm not up on Russian history. Their intent was to get rid of Judaism. They didn't want to necessarily get rid of Jews. They want to get rid of Judaism. And there's all kinds of things. And there was, as we talked about before, by the 1880s, it was state-sponsored pogroms to kill Jews when all the Jews decided to leave and move out. So he was instructed to go with his brother, his older brother, who was 20 years older than him. The older brother, the Rebbe Yehuda Leib, was to accompany Rebbe Shmuel on this mission. And Rebbe Shmuel said, we have to stay focused. We are going as emissaries of our father. And therefore, when someone comes to you to ask them for a blessing for health or wealth or whatever, you should say no. Otherwise, I'm not going with you. So he said, okay, I promise. Okay, they got to a certain village. And wherever they went right to the Mariel. They went right to the Vishuddhalev, the older brother, and asked him for blessings, because this is what people did. They just, he was known to be a miracle worker. But he refused. There was one woman who said, Rebbe, I need a blessing. I have to have children. I've never had children. I'm married so long. So he says, go to my father. My father will for sure give you a blessing. So she started screaming, I'm not going to your father. It's so hard to me, et cetera, et cetera. You're here. Give me a bracha. So she would not leave him alone. But he couldn't contain himself. And he said, go to my brother. So he kept his promise. So now this woman came and started harassing the younger rabbi, Reb Shmuel. Please, Rabbi, I need a bracha. She started crying and screaming and relenting. She wouldn't let him go. And he just said, go to my father. No. They were on a mission. They were not there to bless people. He wanted to stay focused. He said finally to his brother, okay, let's get out of here. So what did this lady do? She put a brake on the carriage. She like stuffed a stick into the pole, into the spokes, and buried it in the ground so they couldn't move the wagon. It's just like, finally, he took a look at her and said, oh, go eat a bagel, which in Yiddish is the same thing as go jump in a lake. Okay, that's a type of expression. A year and a half later, by this time, I'll tell you exactly when the story happened. The story happened in 1860, because a year and a half later, 1862, the Rebbe Marash was now the Rebbe, as his father had passed away. And one day a man came with two cakes for the Rebbe to thank him for his blessing. So he said, why are you here? What's this about? He said, well, you gave a blessing to my wife that she should have a baby, and she had a baby. She said, thank you. So he says, tell me the story. He said, well, he reminded him of the story about this woman who wouldn't leave him alone, and you yelled at her, go eat a bagel. So what did she do? She went, she ate a bagel. So he said, so why are you bringing me two cakes? So he said, because we had twins. So the Rebbe smiled at her and said, I didn't tell her she had to eat two bagels. So that's going to do it. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you back again next week. Take care.